Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
New Hampshire Center for Cognitive and Behavioral Therapies, providing outpatient, evidence-based, specialty behavioral health and substance use disorder services. NHCCBT.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Not again was how many Americans reacted yesterday, hearing the news of another mass shooting, this one in Las Vegas. For victims and their loved ones, the grief and shock are unimaginable. And even people with no direct connection to this incident still feel a collective sense of shock and grief. Lots of Americans are asking lots of questions, including how and why one person could kill and hurt so many. Also, how to manage public anxiety and public safety in the wake of these mass shootings. Today in The Exchange, how are you reacting to this? Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have four guests for the hour. Perry Plummer is here, director of the New Hampshire Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. He's got a 30-year background in emergency response and management, including time as a firefighter. Perry Plummer, really nice to see you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, James Ramsey, coordinator of the Homeland Security Program and professor of security studies at UNH with more than 20 years of experience in the fields of public health and emergency management. And Jim, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you, Laura. Glad to be here.
Also with us, Jerry King, president of Human Dynamics Associates, a social psychologist and former psychotherapist. And Jerry, thank you for being generous with your time.
Sad day, but happy to be with you.
Yeah, thank you so much. And also with us, Leanne Tigert, hospice care manager for the Concord Regional Visiting Nurse Association, where she supervises chaplains and social workers in bereavement. She's also a licensed pastoral psychotherapist and ordained minister. And Leanne, a big welcome to you, too. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, Leanne, I want to start with you. What feelings come up for people with this latest mass shooting, even those who don't know a soul involved in this tragedy?
The feelings that come up are the feelings of grief. Normal, natural, private, public, complicated grief. That's what we are in the midst of as a nation. And so, first of all, let me say thank you for doing this today, because one of the ways of healing public and complicated grief is talking about it, acknowledging it so that we can process it. We are resilient. We are a resilient people, not just in this country, but all human beings are resilient. And grief is a natural process, and our resiliency, we can get through it, but we get through it together. So there's grief, which is a natural, normal process to any kind of loss. There's complicated grief. Now, all people, when they feel grief, grief always feels complicated.
Right.
But what we mean sort of clinically by that is that things complicate the process of natural grieving and healing. There's two primary concerns or issues that complicate grief. One of those is traumatic loss, so a grief that you're not prepared for. Like, I work with hospice, so people prepare for loss. But when there's a traumatic loss, unexpected, surprising, overwhelming.
Like this.
Right. And also when there's multiple losses. So with multiple losses, you can grieve as a nation or as an individual. You go through the process of grieving one loss. But before you can complete that process, so to speak, you have another loss that knocks you down. And then you have another loss that knocks you down. So we grieve Orlando, and suddenly we're grieving Las Vegas, and grieving Sandy Hook, and grieving all these other things that are all combined into a very complicated mess, basically, emotionally.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned those other incidents, because you're right. They seem to just keep coming and coming, and you sort of semi-recover from one, and you're hit with another. So how does that make it even more complicated? And how do you find your resiliency in the face of it's not just one, but it's another and another?
Right. I think there are ways to find resiliency. I think it's really easy to give up and feel overwhelmed. And in fact, when I was leaving the hospice house yesterday, I was talking with some staff members about this show, and they said, yeah, we feel totally numb about what happened. We're like, oh, so 50 some odd people were killed and it's a beautiful day in New Hampshire and I can't take this in. And that is not a helpful way to get through public grief. It's a natural way we all sort of pull into ourselves in a sense when we're overwhelmed. We get into the normal response to a trauma, which is sort of the fight, flight, or freeze. Many of us freeze. Also, in the process of grief, there's what we call denial in the beginning stage. So I think we kind of had a little, what I call the sort of natural Novocaine of denial yesterday. It's just too hard to take in, so we don't quite take it in. But there are ways to heal, and I don't know if you want to go through that specifically now or...
We'll definitely talk about it. I want to bring Jerry in, too, though. You know, thoughts and feelings, Jerry, and the idea that Leanne raises of public grief.
Mm-hmm. Leanne, I'm so glad that you talked about the normalization of that. Yesterday, what I heard from people is, I can't let it go. I'm upset. I can't get on with my day. And it reminded me when the Challenger exploded, they asked me to come on this station to field phone calls in the evening. And my first response was, I can't do that. I'm too upset. I'm too distressed. I'm too emotional. And then I thought, wait a second, that's a normal reaction. And if I cry on the radio, I cry along with everybody else. I think the other thing that's really distressed people in this is the unknown. The perpetrator does not fit a particular profile. And we now know, research shows over and over again, that the unknown is among Americans' biggest fear. And I would suggest that's true worldwide. People would rather have a bad diagnosis than no diagnosis so they can make a plan. So when you're stuck with the unknown combined with the grief that Leanne describes, it can be overwhelming. I agree. I think just going inside ourselves, locking our doors is not helpful. I think it's okay to talk to people. And if they don't want to talk, you find somebody else to share it with.
I talked to a lot of, you know, friends and family yesterday, and a lot of them had the same reaction that Leanne mentioned. I'm overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. I can't deal with it. It's a beautiful day. And I'm tuning it out. I'm shutting it off. I mean, is that okay?
I think that's not an unusual response, but it's coupled with guilt, meaning how can I enjoy this beautiful day when people are suffering so much?
Right.
Should I not just be frightened and scared? So it's so many mixed emotions. And, you know, what I say to people, and they say, I don't know who to talk to because I tried to talk to my cousin and he or she didn't want to respond. Then you find somebody you can talk to and share it. There is not an easy conclusion. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about sharing how we're experiencing this, articulating it.
Go ahead, Leanne.
One of the phrases that I use a lot to describe what Jerry's talking about is that this is a shared reality, and so it's a shared recovery. And so for us to heal through this process, we connect one-on-one with each other and talk about it. But also the public rituals of mourning, I think, are very, very helpful. Mm-hmm. Because they're acknowledging what is sort of unspeakable. Grief is something that we can describe, but if you're grieving, you know that no words adequately describe what's happening. But the rituals, I think, are actually quite helpful. And then I think allowing space for people to also grieve individually in the way that we do. There's no right or wrong way to do this. I don't think it's bad to feel overwhelmed, crying all day, or overwhelmed and feeling nothing all day when this first happens. But if people are still feeling that in 6 months, then I'm really concerned.
You know, we've been hearing so many stories about the amazing efforts of police and first responders in Las Vegas. It's just so impressive, and that's not even a big enough word for it. And Perry, after an event like Las Vegas, what's the conversation among law enforcement, first responders, officials such as yourself involved in emergency management?
Well, there's certainly a couple of different things that obviously when an event happens like that, they've gone through years and hours and days of training for these types of events, and they deal with them in small amounts every day, the first responders. So they're doing their job. You know, after that, is really when they have to sit back and they feel a lot of this stuff that the public feels and have to, and a lot of first responders take that with them for the rest of their lives. You know, so there's the human response as an individual responder, and they'll do a lot of counseling and crisis management on that stuff. And then the second piece is the learning. You know, can that happen here? I mean, our first thoughts are, from a reactionary standpoint, is, you know, in my job and in the people that in our group that we sit down and say, all right, first of all, what happened? How did it happen? What do we learn from it? Is there a nexus to New Hampshire? Because our first thought is, how do we protect our citizens of New Hampshire and make sure that it doesn't happen here? And so, or try to prevent it from happening here. So the first thing we do is there a nexus to New Hampshire? Any one of these events, we get on a national conference call with FBI, CIA, DHS, state police, local police, myself, and say, okay, so what do we know? And we get these classified briefs to see, is there a nexus to New Hampshire? In this case, there isn't a nexus to New Hampshire. You know, did he come from New Hampshire? Did he live in New Hampshire? Did he have, you know, ties to New Hampshire from an investigative standpoint? And so, and the second piece is, okay, so do we have that type of venue? Could that happen here, and how do we prevent it? Well, we do have large gatherings here. You know, is it Las Vegas? No. But is there events that could happen? Absolutely. So we turn towards action items to say, you know, what are we doing with our planning and our security assessments and our threat assessments, and put things into place to prevent this? Far more events are stopped than are carried out in this country. So, you know, unfortunately, this is one that got through the cracks. But for the most part, a lot of those are stopped long before they happen through good intel. You know, and see something, say something is really a piece that we all can latch on to. You know, the best way to prevent any of this stuff is public vigilance. In this case, there's very few indicators. I think Jerry mentioned, you know, he didn't fit the profiles from what it's looking like right now. But almost every single time, there are indicators for the people close around somebody or the neighbor. And so we're saying, if you see something, say something, no matter how insignificant it be, report to authorities to try to prevent these things.
Well, and Jim, I want to turn to you as well. But Perry, I have to say, you know, this took place at a big outdoor concert. There have been other issues at public gatherings. I mean, here in New Hampshire, you know, fall foliage festivals, Concord Market Days, you know, that wonderful band shell at Hampton Beach where people gather. You know, the Highland Games up at Loon Mountain. I mean, we love these big events. They're wonderful. We're outside. It's beautiful. I just wonder how you even begin to prevent, protect when you've got so many people, you know, just out in a large open area.
So obviously there's a lot of things where you see bag checks, you see law enforcement, you see high visibility efforts being done at all those events. But there's a lot of things that are happening that the public does not see. There's undercover people, there's intel. We do a threat assessment through our information analysis center, statewide information analysis center, and with federal threats and local threats, we do threat assessments on all these venues. We're looking for those types of things. We're looking at social media, public social media posts. We're looking at all those things to say, are there indicators that this can happen? And then there's all kinds of planning and the way that people move and have eyes on people, you know, sometimes it's metal tech, sometimes not. But there's a whole host of efforts that the public never sees. So I think the one thing that people have to understand is there are a lot of efforts to prevent this type of thing going on at every event that they go to. And they can rest assured that our local law enforcement, our state law enforcement, our federal agencies are doing everything they can to keep them safe at these venues. And quite frankly, the only way someone like this wins is if it changes our lives and we stop going to venues and stop doing these things. We learn from everyone. We'll do an after action on this nationally, and we'll learn. We learn from Virginia Tech. We learn from Sandy Hook. We learn from all of these things. We have a school security program that we've done in-person security assessments on 73% of our public schools and worked with those schools to make our schools safer after Sandy Hook. So we learn from these, and we always are trying to keep the public safe. But there's a tremendous amount of efforts going on to keep these venues safe, whether it be the Seafood Fest or NASCAR or concerts. There's a tremendous amount going on in collaboration that goes on. And in a small state, the relationship between the FBI, DHS, state police, Homeland Security, and local law enforcement, local EMS, there's a tremendous team effort there in this state. I'm really proud of the relationships that we've built, and that is the first line of prevention.
So a lot going on behind the scenes that we don't even know about. And Jim, you know, this attack is being called a lone wolf attack. Everybody's alluded to the fact that, you know, this person doesn't seem to have any weird background, or gee, we should have known that. It just seemed to come out of nowhere. I mean, In terms of security, how do you even begin to prepare for that or prevent that when something just seems to, you know, blow up from nowhere?
Well, Laura, that's the $64,000 right. question. And I would like to just commend the panelists here for touching on some really key points. You know, Leanne mentioned the concept of grief and having a public conversation around that. I really think we need a public conversation around us as a country, our culture of preparedness, our culture of violence, sort of the things that we kind of lean to as a nation. Director Plummer is absolutely spot on. There are a lot of things that are done on a regular basis that should make people feel safe. These things are going to happen. You can't profile everything. We live in a free society. The free society allows people to mindfully determine to be violent. And this perpetrator, Mr. Paddock, is not the kind of guy that would have been prevented by any sort of a law. I don't necessarily rush to using the word terrorism at this point because he wasn't ideologically driven, as best we can tell. In fact, quite the opposite from listening to his brother yesterday. So I think the fear of, are there another one out there? You started the show by saying, not again. Yes, let's acquiesce to the concept that we have great fears that we should acknowledge. But that doesn't necessarily mean we should actually change our lives. If this were a terrorism incident, we could almost say, well, that's an ISIS ideologically driven event. Gosh darn those guys. Let's do something about those guys and move on. We connect our fear. We connect our anger. We connect our sense of right and retribution to that. But this isn't that. So it leaves us a little more hollow. We don't really know where to direct our concept of anger and what to do next. But I think going forward, to answer your question, we go forward, as Director Plummer mentioned, we go forward, rest assured that we have amazing law enforcement. We have world-class first responders in every single state. Day in and day out, tons of things happen quite beautifully, safely, securely. And yet, at the end of the day, these things can happen.
The exchange number for you to join us with your thoughts, reactions from here in the Granite State, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Here in New Hampshire, people are processing the grief, anger, anxiety after this event in Las Vegas and others before it, as Leanne mentioned. This hour in The Exchange, we're tapping into that conversation, and we want you to join it. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. You mentioned, Jim, the word terrorism, and some people are calling this domestic terrorism, mostly Democrats, couple Republicans. How do you define it? I want to let everybody know, too, that Senator Shaheen's going to be with us later, so we'll ask her about that. But does it really matter if we call it domestic terrorism or not? I mean, if I'm in Las Vegas, I'm terrified.
Right. Remember, the root word of terrorism is terror. Terrorism has a variety of definitions. If you look at the U.S. Code, if you look at the United Nations, if you look at the FBI, there are a variety of definitions of terrorism, quite, you know, speaking legally. However, there are common elements that transcend all the common definitions of terrorism. One is there has to be a violent act. Two, that violent act has to be perpetrated against innocent bystanders or non-combatants. Third, there has to be some sort of ideological driven component behind this. And, you know, when you look at the concept of terrorism as perpetrated by the San Bernardino perpetrators or, anything that would happen in Europe, the bombing in Manchester, the use of the bus on the London Bridge. We don't necessarily see that in this particular case. Now, realize that all terrorism is crime, but not all crime is terrorism. So this is an example of violent crime, and people are terrified. But from a practical perspective and a legal perspective, I'm not sure we can actually label it as terrorism yet, despite, you know, the need to kind of label it as something in order to help process it and move forward.
Well, we'll talk a lot more in just a moment. And let's hear from you. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Stay with us. Thank you.
want to know why it is that people suggest telling your congressional representatives how you feel about the issues. Does it make a difference?
Who can answer the burning questions about government operations?
How does the Electoral College work? Is the system outdated in our current democracy system?
What is a filibuster, and what purpose does it serve in the government?
Who can help us cleave these Gordian knots?
Civics 101.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, New Hampshire reaction to the mass shooting in Las Vegas. Many Granite Staters have been following this news with dismay, anger, fear, asking why one person would kill and hurt so many. Also, how to manage public safety and public anxiety, given the rise in these incidents. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Jerry King, James Ramsey, Leanne Tigert, Perry Plummer, a couple more threads I want to pick up on before we go to our listeners. And Leanne, it's this feeling of grief exhaustion in a way. I mean, not only these series of mass shootings that you mentioned earlier, but also, you know, hurricanes in Texas, hurricanes in Puerto Rico now, Florida. So it's just this feeling of how can you process your anger, frustration, grief when there's so much?
Good question. I think the reality is that all of us are living in the midst of this sort of traumatic grief, complicated grief, public grief that is overwhelming. And so two things. One thing is that remembering that we are resilient and we are made to get through this. But that we also, this doesn't happen quickly. So there is a process of getting through this, but there is a time that it takes to heal. And sadly, I think the reality is that every time we have another event, it's like a domino effect. Everything else gets kicked up, and we kind of go back to ground one and starting over. But I think we have to be really generous to ourselves and loving to ourselves individually and as a community, that there is a process that takes time with this. So like when I talked about the public memorials being important, I do think they're important to acknowledge sort of metaphorically the grief that we feel inside. And they're important because they bring people together rather than staying isolated in their own homes. They're not helpful if they just stop there, though. They're not helpful if people say, okay, that's, you know, we're just stuck in this grief. It's a process. That's sort of the beginning. First, we're kind of in shock. Then we acknowledge through the memorials. And then we move into action, whatever that may be. And that's a whole nother conversation of what that means for people.
How do you talk to people, Leanne, about, you know, feeling okay in when you know, I think Jerry mentioned it earlier, maybe it was Jim, that, you know, yesterday was a beautiful day in New Hampshire. And there we are, and it's fall, and it's everybody, you know, a lot of people's favorite season. So how do you deal with that? Like, it's a gorgeous day, and I want to be happy, but I feel bad being happy.
So in grief counseling, part of what we try to do is normalize for people that what's going on internally with them rarely, if ever, matches the external. So it's a beautiful day. It's like if someone has a private loss, the death of a family member, and they walk down Main Street in Concord and life is going on. It's very disorienting for people.
And people at the grocery store say, you know, how are you?
Yeah. And what
have
do you
a
say?
Nice day.
Right. Actually, I'm just so sad I can't stand it. Right. You don't say that in the grocery aisle. But I think we sort of have to learn to say a little bit of that in the grocery aisle. We have to say, this is really hard. We have to say what's going on for me internally is overwhelming to me. I'm not quite sure how to manage that. How do you manage it? And to really share our coping skills with one another.
You know, Jerry, Perry talked earlier about, you know, first responders. And I'd love to hear from you, too, because you worked with first responders. Mm-hmm. You know, they're so valiant. They're so brave. They rush in. They save people. I mean, it's incredible, the stories that we're hearing. But it's tough for them. They see just all these horrible things going on around them, and it must have an impact.
It does. I worry most about the delayed reaction. It's really important to normalize that it will come to them days later, sometimes months later, because they're so busy doing their jobs, being professional. We know a lot about vicarious trauma. We know a lot about compassion fatigue, and they do too. They understand it. But when you're doing your job, you don't pay attention to that. You can't. And so people will often say months later, oh, it's a gorgeous day, everything's fine, and I'm not happy. What they're not happy about is it's finally probably coming up to the top for them. We also have anniversary situations. So you can, and this could go on for decades, by the way, where you think, I don't understand why I'm feeling so badly. And the question often is, did something happen? Were you involved in something a long time ago around this time of year? The other thing I wanted to mention that people ask a lot about is, what do you do with kids and children who know this is going on, who know the adults in their lives are not happy? I feel very strongly that we have to be honest with them. And part of the honesty is, most of the world is good. What we are seeing is somebody who did something awful. That doesn't mean most of the world is bad. And so to be able to acknowledge, yes, we're upset, your teachers are upset, other adults are distressed about this for good reason, without terrifying the children to a point where they don't feel like they can go out the door.
Right, and you can't hide it from kids once they're past a certain age, because they all hear about it. Even if they don't have smartphones, their friends have them, and they hear about it.
Even when they're very young, I don't think you can hide it, because they know something's happening. And like adults, kids' fantasies are worse than reality.
Go ahead, Leanne, and then let's go to call.
Related to that, both for children and for adults, one of the, I think, the worst things we can do that will slow or stop our process is get stuck watching the same story, listening to the same story over and over again. I have talked to people, psychotherapy clients, who just, you know, the news media is on 24/7. Kids are walking through the living room. They see it over and over and over and over again. You know, news is fabulous. Let's get the news, but then let's just get the news and not re-traumatize ourselves by hearing the same story over and over again.
Well, it does seem that everywhere these days there are television sets, whether you want to see them or not, whether your kids want to see them or not, doctors' waiting rooms, you know, airports and so forth. So,
I've been known to walk in and turn them off.
Well, I have tried, but sometimes you can't do it because it's remotely set up. Let's go to our listeners, all of you. Wesley's calling from Epping. Hi, Wesley. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I just had this point that I have been sort of discussing a little bit with some people on Facebook as far as the definition of terrorism, and I just want to pose the question to you and the panel here. What isn't ideological about someone who obviously had no exit strategy, who intended to die in this, that would go publicly and execute as many people as possible? You know, there, we may not identify that with a specific, you know, mainstream ideological belief system, but in my opinion, that is a pretty strong ideological set, and that's really all I want to say.
Well, so thank you, Wesley, because I'd like to pick up with you, Perry, and you, Jim, on this, you know, conversation we had before the break about, should we call this domestic terrorism, and if we did, how would that change things? So, Perry, you first.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously for the victims and the victims' families, it really doesn't matter what we call it. I mean, you know, and it's really a little academic to even put a label on it. Sometimes when you call it terrorism, it brings more resources. So sometimes we look at it from that standpoint.
Well, that's
because,
what I'm wondering.
You know, it
yeah.
changes some of the way that it can be investigated. It's changing some of the resources that get brought to bear. And I think we need to look at that, because I think we need to bring all resources to every crime. But in our business, because I get involved in homeland security issues, but I don't get involved in every crime stuff. So we are always looking at that, you know, at what level does it become homeland security or a terrorism event, of, you know, opposed to a robbery or regular crime. So, you know, it's very difficult to define. What I would say is, let's not get hung up on the definition. Yeah. Let's get hung up on some of the solutions, some of the things that, you know, how do we prevent it? How do we react to it? How do we get back to our normal lives? How do we recover from it, rather than putting connecting a term to it? Sometimes when we connect terrorism to it, people feel better, because they feel as though it's something. This is one of those ones that's in the gray area that can happen to us. I mean, it's like when you hear of a child getting abducted and you say, oh, it was a family member. You're almost happy that it was a family member that did it, or it was a neighbor, because you say, that couldn't happen to my child because we're not in that same situation. This one has that little bit of grayness to it that is a little concerning.
Would it be, if incidents like this were defined as terrorism, would it be easier to investigate, look around, more resources? I mean, would it help or not?
Well, I mean, I think Jim touched on it, that, you know, we live in a free society, and we want to make sure that continues to be that way, and protecting people's rights and civil liberties is extremely important in these things. So you have to be really careful of how you how you look at those things, because you don't want the medicine to be worse than the than the disease, and say, okay, we change laws, we do these things for this one event that might not have got prevented anyways, and then we change how we live. So it's a little bit concerning. But one of the points I would like to make is what I find, being a first responder, and I think I'd love to hear Leanne and Jerry mention this, is I find that conversations with children on this stuff and conversations with other people is, if we can give action items or planning items, what can we do about this? How do we prevent it in our lives? How do we make ourselves safer? Or, things like home escape plans or meeting places. So you can have a conversation with your child and say, if something would happen, let us, you know that we're prepared to deal with it. And I think those make the conversations a little bit easier. And a couple things I just want to mention is to train for an active shooter event, whether it be in the public or in your business, you can do run, hide, fight, or avoid, deny, defend. You can go to readynh.gov, and we have information about those on that website. You can go to the DHS website and take a course about run, hide, fight if it happens in your office building or it happens when you're in a crowd. And I think that is one way to recover, is start to think about, okay, I'm not going to stop going to these places, but I want to be more prepared. So that preparedness piece, I think, and those action items. And even with the hurricane, people are starting to donate to them, and that's where I'm headed for a donation collection event. But those action items, I think, help us, if we help others, help us recover from this as well.
Well, local police departments have been going to businesses and schools and organizations and giving those trainings. And people do say, Perry, that they're helpful. They feel good. I know you do have to go in connection with the hurricane relief effort that you're helping out with. So, Perry Plummer, we'll let you go. We really, really appreciate you coming in.
Thank you very much. And I did want to mention that there, till 6 o'clock tonight, we are accepting non-perishable foods and water at the State House. You just have to pull up. We'll take it right out of your car to send to Puerto Rico to help those poor people in Puerto Rico.
Okay. Thank you so much. That's Perry Plummer, Director of the New Hampshire Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Jim, you want to jump in? Go ahead.
Sure. Thank you. I just wanted to kind of echo the concept of catastrophic loss and its resultant need for better mental health in our country. When people experience catastrophic loss, whether it's poor technology, it's a bad guy, it's Mother Nature, there's an awful lot of mental health consequences to that. And we experience catastrophic loss, whether it's through the 80 wildfires out west, bad weather, or yesterday in Vegas, or Pulse, or even September 11. And I think we need to do a better job. I'm curious about having personal grief resolution processes in one's lives, but how do we have a national conversation about where we need to go to be resilient? How do we scale up individual resilience and grief processing to the national level? The other point that I kind of wanted to make is that uncertainty is an extremely uncomfortable part of the human condition. It typically breeds fear, and Americans tend to be afraid of things that we maybe shouldn't be afraid of. To push on back on your point just a little bit regarding terrorism, it turns out that when people look at these issues, Americans are – the number one fear Americans have is of terrorism. But when you look at sort of a proper definition of terrorism as it's existing all around the world, we're pretty safe as a nation. State when it comes to terrorism happening to the average person.
To that strict definition.
Absolutely.
But almost 60 people were killed and 500 hurt, so
right.
That doesn't make people feel safe.
Well, no, it doesn't. No, but what I'm thinking is that we also have to guard against every piece of violent crime being considered, because if everything's terrorism all the time, it really moves us into a direction of fear. Then politics become fear-based politics, and we make decisions. Look, if you look at the legislative responses over time to bad things happening, aviation security is a good example. We have a shoe bomber. We have one guy. And that was thwarted, but we've all taken our shoes off at every airport for the last how many years? And so we have these massive legislative responses based on this kind of concept. I'm just kind of wanting to make sure that we kind of put some bookends around that a little bit and kind of go from there. And I think we need to help people understand that some uncertainty in life is okay, and we need to ascend to that.
Go ahead, Leanne.
I just wanted to respond to that because I think there's lots of conversation about prepare. We have, all these code silver drills and such, and prepare. Well, that's good to know what to do. But it also can be bad because people's anxiety goes up and feel like they're constantly having to be vigilant. And so that kind of hypervigilance is sort of a characteristic of post-traumatic stress disorder. So do we have post-traumatic stress disorder as a nation when we just, you know, ratchet ourselves up into this kind of hypervigilance? So I would say the antidote to preparing is to a mindfulness acceptance, in a sense, that we are not in control, but a mindfulness of being present in the present moment. You know, that stuff is not happening right here, right now, at this time. You know, when I'm walking down the street at market days, I could let my mind go all kinds of places. But if I can mindfully, in a mental health or spiritual kind of way, keep it present that I'm walking down the street at market days and I see my friends and all is well, then I don't give in to that anxiety. And I think that's a really key factor. And yes, we need a lot more mental health services to help us all do that.
Well, that's a hard balance to strike, though. You're right, mm-hmm. to sort of do, you know, what reasonable preparations you can, like Perry talked about. Of course, you should have a meeting place with your family if something goes wrong. But I hear you, Leanne. If you're overprepared and overvigilant, then you're kind of always in that fight or flight mode, and that's not good for your health.
Right. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's go to another caller. Wesley, thank you again so much for that one. And Mike's in Goffstown. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
Sure.
A deeper question. Why, and this happens over and over and over again with all these mass shootings, why are these people that are committing the crime taking their own life? If you think about a serial killer, serial killers typically just kill people. Why do these people commit suicide after taking so many lives? What is going on? That's the deeper question. Why are people doing this? This is happening. It's happened so many times. Nobody's really examining that deeper question of what is driving these people to commit these heinous crimes. And then after it's done, they don't bask in the glory of it. Take their own lives.
Yeah.
Something is fundamentally wrong with this society, and it seems to be an American problem. So we need to ask those deeper questions.
Mike, it's a great question. Thank you so much, and I wish we knew. And Jerry King, everybody's looking at you. That's a hard one.
And then I'm going to look at Leanne. I think often it's a suicide. It's a decision to commit suicide prior to the event. I don't think most people kill themselves because they did this. I think they decided that they were going to take their own lives, and sadly, a lot of people with them, for whatever that statement means. But I think we also need to, and Leanne, I certainly want your response on that. In my past career, I worked with people who were considered dangerous. I worked in neighborhoods that were considered dangerous. And I will reiterate what I said before. Most of the people that I came across were fine people, good people, who lived with this and understood that this was a possibility. I think what happens is people would like to call it terrorism or something else so there's an explanation and they can get on with their lives, meaning my life is not part of that. And we look for escape, and that's one way to escape. But Leanne, I'm interested in if you think my response about the person being suicidal prior to doing this, maybe so.
I would assume absolutely, yeah. Of course. I think if you there's a lot about objectification in order to commit suicide or homicide. There's a mental process. I want to be careful that we don't just suggest that everyone with mental illness or has suicidal impulses
absolutely.
Would do this, which
wants
I'm not
to
suggesting.
Hurt others.
Right. But I do think that there is an objectifying of life and a grandiose stand of that with this.
Well, coming up, a lot more of your calls. And also, U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen will be with us, so we'll talk to her a little bit. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, New Hampshire reaction to the mass shooting in Las Vegas. Grander staters have been following the news with fear, dismay, anger, asking how and why this could happen. Also, how to manage public safety at large events. We've talked about that. And public anxiety over these incidents. The exchange number for you to join us with your thoughts, questions, feelings, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, right back to our listeners. Steve's in Nottingham. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
I want to thank the show for what you're doing. What the people began at the top of the show talked about is talking about it. The first thing people do is they isolate. When I heard it, the first thing I did is I called my rabbi. The second thing I did is I went out and jogged, and I talked to anyone I could find and just talk about how you feel. I feel, as an American, that I was hurt. A stake was driven through my heart as an American. Yes, it did bring us together, but reminds us we're all Americans. And that was very powerful. And to be, I'm going to go to a very informal prayer service today at Club of 11, where my synagogue, Yitayim, and the Church of Transfiguration has a prayer session so that I can share it and talk to other people, and that's what this show has done.
Well, Steve, I'm glad you appreciate it. Yeah.
God bless this show and what you're doing for the health of New Hampshire.
Thank you so much, Steve. And it's, you know, speaking as a journalist, I mean, journalists, I'm not on the front lines covering this, Jerry King, but those journalists who are, it's traumatic for them. You heard it in their voices yesterday. And even at this level, you know, you kind of take a bath in this stuff. And it's tough. So I really appreciate that call, Steve. Thank you so much. Jerry.
Well, when I talked about vicarious trauma, compassion fatigue, I should have included journalists. Receptionists at hospitals who in the ER who
Absolutely.
See people come in.
Nurses.
The important thing, thankfully, I loved when Perry said we have counselors on board. That didn't used to be true. What used to be true was if I'm a police officer, I can't say that I'm upset about this because people will think I'm not professional. That has changed completely. And also, I just want to reiterate what you said, Leon, is we have to be very careful about generalizing. When you said most mentally ill people are not dangerous, that's absolutely true. Most people who are inmates or former inmates will not be dangerous necessarily. And so we can't just generalize and say people in a category are bound to do this.
And yet we do that because it makes it easier
it
for
does.
Us. It's that human desire for putting the world in, you know, little boxes so that we can understand it.
Especially then if you can say those boxes aren't part of my life.
That's right.
Absolutely.
I'm guilty as charged. I mean, you just kind of want to make sense of it all. Go ahead, Jim.
That's a great point. And I've been on the phone with several folks that I'm doing some research with around the country. And one of the guys is a large black fellow from New York, a former NYPD. And his comment is, thank goodness this wasn't a black guy that did this. And I had someone else that mentioned, you know what? I noticed that this was a homegrown American. This was not a refugee or an immigrant or a person of color. And I think that that would have just added so much more complexity to this issue that we have violence in our society that is something that we need to be vigilant about. And we have a lot of mechanisms in place, but there is uncertainty and we need to kind of manage that in our own lives as well. But that it's maybe easy to connect us to something in order to help process it and say, gosh darn, all that one, you know, you fill in the blank category. But that's not necessarily the case here. And it's the lack of profile and it's the lack of understanding. It's the lack of motive that just redoubles the uncertainty of all of this.
Let's take another call. This is Tom in Concord. Hi, Tom, you're on the exchange. Welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Laura. I just wanted to point out that the gentleman addressed the issue of fear, and I think you mentioned it. And in my mind, the government of the United States of America has been breeding the idea of fear ever since the 9/11 attacks. And if you breed and pander to people around the issue of fear, they're going to be afraid and it will tip over into almost paranoia. And, of course, that has to be directed someplace. And like the gentleman said, thank God it wasn't a black American that shot. Thank God it wasn't a Muslim that shot. Thank God it wasn't somebody else that shot that would bring people's attention towards one of the minorities that is absolutely no, in my mind, no different than any other American. So, again, well, if you breed fear, you get fear. Thank you very much.
Tom, thank you so much. And I'm going to let a response sit for a moment now because we have U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen on the line with us. And Senator Shaheen, thank you for taking time out. We really appreciate it.
Well, good morning, Laura. This is such a heartbreaking tragedy, and I know that we're all wishing the people who were injured a swift recovery and that we all send our condolences to those people who were killed, to their families, and to their friends.
What's the latest that you're hearing, Senator Shaheen, about the investigation into this shooting?
I haven't gotten any news that hasn't been public, so I don't have any insider classified information about the shooting.
Well, and our last caller mentioned something that's come up a lot this hour, Senator Shaheen. You know, Americans who are fearful for their safety, fearful for their loved ones, you know, maybe reconsidering going to that concert or that outdoor event. And I wonder what you want to say to those folks, Senator Shaheen.
Well, I've actually been impressed by the response from the city of Las Vegas and from all of the folks who were at the concert, the number of acts of heroism, the people who have said, you know, we're not going to let this keep us from enjoying our music or enjoying being in Las Vegas. And I think that's one of the things that we need to focus on and need to remind people that what people like this deranged shooter want us to do is to be fearful. And our best response to that is not to be fearful. It's to be careful, to be thoughtful about where we go, to make sure we're being safe, but not to let this kind of horrible incident rule our lives.
The Democratic National Committee labeled the Las Vegas shooting terror. A couple of your fellow Democrats have referred to this as an act of domestic terror. At least one or two Republicans have also called the shooter a domestic terrorist. What are your thoughts, Senator Shaheen, about whether we should label this terrorism or not? I mean, my goodness, 500 people injured, you know, about 60 people dead. It's terrifying, to be sure.
Well, look, I think this is terrorism, and then I don't think terrorism is dependent upon who is the perpetrator. It's dependent upon what the action is and how people respond. And so maybe we need to take a look at how we measure incidents like this at the federal level.
So would you use the word terrorism or domestic terrorism to describe this event?
I would.
You would. And how does that change, if at all, Senator Shaheen? And you're on, you know, you're on committees that look at this, Armed Services, Foreign Relations. Does that change the way we approach these incidents, the way we try to ferret them out before they happen?
I don't know the answer to that. I think one of the very positive actions that happened Sunday night was the response of the police and all of the first responders, the medical community, how fast law enforcement got in and identified where the shooting was coming from and got in. So I do think they are going to continue to approach these kinds of incidents in the best way possible to try and get at who the shooter is and protect people. And that's what's really important.
And Senator Shaheen, we recognize that gun control, gun rights are part of this story for many listeners. I want to let listeners know that we will talk about this. NPR is looking at this. We'll talk about it. We plan to talk about it in a future exchange show, but this has been a rapidly developing story. We don't have all the details yet. But for you, as a politician who works on legislation, votes on legislation, what do you think needs to happen in terms of gun laws regarding this latest tragedy?
Well, as we all know, New Hampshire has a very long and strong tradition of safe and legal firearm use. We believe in the Second Amendment, but I think we can address gun violence and still respect the rights of gun owners. And I think hopefully this will produce another debate in Congress and in the country about what is the best way to make sure we are as safe as possible when people use firearms.
It'll produce a debate. Do you think it'll produce any change?
That remains to be seen. I certainly hope so. But the more people discuss what choices we have, what we should be doing, the more Congress is going to pay attention and respond.
Do you want to talk about any particular changes that you'd like to see in our gun law, Senator Shaheen?
Well, I certainly, after the Newtown shooting of so many children, I supported background checks. I think that was an approach that we ought to be doing. I hope we will look at that again, because we know that makes a difference in terms of keeping guns out of the hands of people who should not have them. So I think that's one of the things we ought to be looking at.
All right. And Senator Shaheen, I know you have to go. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
That's U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen, again, former governor of New Hampshire. She was last reelected in 2014. Committee assignments include armed services and foreign relations. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Governor Sununu said recently gun reform should be on the back burner as families mourn victims of mass shooting. Marjorie emails and says, with respect due to the governor, if this is not the time to talk about access to automatic assault weapons, what is the time? And I want to let Marjorie and everybody know that, again, NPR is going to be looking at this. We will be looking at it here in New Hampshire on the Exchange. Not so much today, but we will be looking at it. So I want to let everybody know that. Got another email from Karen who asks basically the same question. Why are you not addressing common sense gun laws? Karen says this continues to happen because weapons of war are allowed to be sold to anyone. Karen, thank you so much. Marjorie, thank you again. This is a rapidly unfolding, evolving story. So we will get on all these aspects of it when we can. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And here's a call from Ingrid in Hopkinton. Hi, Ingrid. You're on the air. Welcome.
Well, hi, Laura. Good
hi.
Good to talk to you. Hi. So, yeah, wonderful, important show. Thank you for doing that. I just wanted to share a few experiences. Being German, we grew up with a lot of trauma in our family and a lot of trauma during the Cold War and, you know, just that constant feeling of threat. And what that has created in us was a level of resiliency that we just look around us and find out very quickly if we're safe or not. And, for example, when 9/11 happened, I saw what was happening in New York, but I realized it wasn't happening here. And so I wasn't traumatized or frozen, because I realized that my call to action now was to put certain pieces in place so that I could protect myself and my family from potential threat that would be there. I've done a lot of trauma work over the years, over 15 years of holistic trauma work with very deep trauma, oftentimes EFT and other things. And I've learned that there's a Dr. Roach Scher is a traumatologist, and he said that our body doesn't know the difference between the intensity of the trauma or the importance of the trauma, but what it understands is the level of helplessness we're in when it happens. So when we perceive ourselves in a sense of helplessness, then we believe that we're traumatized. We actually believe we're going to die. And
that's not good for your physical or your mental state. So let's talk about that. Who wants to jump in on that really important point that Ingrid makes, that, you know, you feel constantly under threat and your body isn't, you know, it's not reacting maybe the way it should. Thank you so much, Ingrid.
Yeah, I think she raises some really great points. I absolutely agree. So when people are traumatized, they can get frozen by the anxiety or unprocessed sort of public grief. People can freeze and give up any sense of power, appropriate sort of self-power and agency. They can fight by lashing out inappropriately or flight, or they just, you know, turn the TV off, run away, whatever it might be. So how do we not feel that? As she was talking, I was thinking about Viktor Frankl, who I have just, you know, he just writes so efficiently about this, so beautifully about this. Talks about living each moment with its dignity, each moment of life, even in a concentration camp. Each moment that each human being is alive is a moment of great dignity, and to be approached with that. So we take action. That action might be writing our legislator. It might be dropping water off at the state house. It might be going outside with our child and having and enjoying the afternoon.
Being you feel guilty sometimes, though, doing that.
Well,
you know? Again, we talked about this
but
earlier.
Both are true.
Such a beautiful
both
day.
Are true.
And, you know,
that is what life is. Life is filled with beauty and joy and wonder and pain and suffering. And we engage in that where we are, when we are with that. And that is really healthy, mentally and spiritually. So we connect with others. We have rituals of mourning, but they're only rituals. They're not the full process. We take good care and we take action.
Here's an email from James. James, running out of time, so I can't read the whole thing. He says, I'm concerned that with all this discussion of consolation and coping, it's easy to lose the energy and impetus it takes to effect change. Can your guests talk more about how we as a society can respond to this in ways that go beyond emotion and into action? And again, James, I'm sorry, I can't read the whole thing. Go ahead, Jerry.
Well, action is certainly cathartic. There's no question. And the result can be wonderful. I think people need to find their area. We can say, well, you have to do big things. You have to testify in front of the legislature. Or maybe you make a phone call. Maybe you talk to some people and help them. Maybe you read to children. Whatever it is that you think you can do is perfectly reasonable. And, you know, I did bring up the guilt that we have when something awful is happening. But I'm glad that you brought up the idea that we're all taking our shoes off at airports. And people talk about that all the time. We don't want to go to the extreme. I'm absolutely convinced that we have to make a decision about how we lead our lives. Is it going to be driven by fear and anxiety or reasonable preparation and response so that we can live a full life? And obviously, I come down on the latter. Because what are the alternatives?
Right. You know, cowering in your basement for the next 30 years doesn't sound like a good option. Go ahead, Jim.
I would just like to say, kind of wrapping things up here today, I mean, we need to be mature as a society and embrace a conversation about violence and about fear and about public grieving. We need to learn how to scale these efforts up. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I would just like to say that we need to do better with mental health. That impacts everything between natural disasters and bad guy events like this. This is a common part. We need a green revolution, a green new deal for the next century. We're not prepared to go into what the next century is going to offer us in terms of threats to our safety and our security. And the last thing I would say is that if people want to get involved, rather than getting useless conversations on social media about kneeling versus standing, show your true patriotism and help someone else in need. Compassion is cathartic. Getting involved relieves freezing and trauma. And I think if you want to help somebody in need, that's your true patriotism right there.
Well, and there is that hurricane drop-off at the State House today that Perry Plummer mentioned earlier. Thanks, all of you, jumping in last minute. We really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.
After a concert in Las Vegas became the scene of a deadly massacre, people rushed to donate blood and support victims' families.
The hate that this one individual, this lone wolf, rained down on our community was met with an outpouring of love by our entire community, and we will get through this together.
I'm Robert Siegel. We'll remember some of the victims this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered this afternoon from 4 till 7 here on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.